Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, author Kim Michelle Richardson discusses her new book, The Bookwoman's Daughter, with American Writers Museum Program Director Allison Sansoni. This conversation was recorded live for the American Writers Festival on May 15th, 2022 in Chicago. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
I want to welcome you to this online program of the American Writers Festival, the inaugural literary event celebrating the American Writers Museum's 5th anniversary. I'm Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director of the American Writers Museum. We're grateful to all of you watching today for supporting the past, present, and future of American writing. We're here today to talk about the power of reading, but the role of books in bringing the idea of a future to life. In The Bookwoman of Troublesome Creek, Kim Michelle Richardson used fascinating New Deal history, a deep knowledge of a land and its people, and stunning imagination to tell the story of a Kentucky packhorse librarian and the world of prejudice and poverty she confronts. The sequel, The Bookwoman's Daughter, continues the tale, and we're thrilled to have Richardson with us to discuss it. She's the author of 5 works of historical fiction and the memoir, The Unbreakable Child. The Bookwoman of Troublesome Creek was recommended by Dolly Parton in People magazine and has earned a 2020 PBS Reader's Choice, 2019 Library Reads Best Book, Indie Next, Forbes Best Historical Novel, Books a Million Best Fiction, and was an Oprah's Buzziest Book Pick and a Women's National Book Association Great Group Read Selection. Welcome, Kim. So start by telling us a little bit about where these characters are, where the bookwoman's daughter finds the characters that we got to know in The Bookwoman of Troublesome Creek.
Well, The Bookwoman's Daughter takes place in 1953, and it's 12 years after Bookwoman ends. So we find Cussie and Jackson Lovett, the parents of Honey, they're being taken away to prison for violating the segregation laws. Honey is sent to live with an elderly family friend that people will know from the last book, Old Loretta. But soon we find Honey on her own, and she's dodging social services and the law because social services wants to lock her up and throw her into the children's working prison here in Kentucky. So she finagles her way, and she ends up taking her mother's library route. And from there, she befriends other women, Appalachia women, doing remarkable jobs. We have Bonnie, the coal miner, who's her husband was a coal miner. He died in the mines, and so that's the only job she can do. We have Pearl. She's a fire tower lookout. And then we have Amara, she's from the Frontier Nursing Service, which was another program way back, you know, in the early 1900s in Kentucky. So someone had said it was remarkable because I just shook my head. It was not believable that these women were doing these type of things in this period, in this place and time. And I thought they were doing more what 4-star generals were doing, and it's about dang time they got some credit for it. The book just shows how far women have come and how much farther we need to go.
What made you decide to return to this story for a sequel?
Well, all my books are set in Kentucky, and this is my home, and these are my people. So, of course, we had a great outpouring of support for Bookwoman and people wanting more and requesting more. So we decided to continue the journey.
So people, when they read the first one, they said, oh no, it can't be over yet, right? They wanted you to keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did the reception to the first book, you know, it got so much attention and so much wonderful praise. And I'm wondering if you kept any particular reviews or reactions in mind as you were writing the second.
Well, yes, of course. First of all, it was always just a privilege to be able to share my Kentucky stories with the outside world. And also that I work with great editors and source books who have let me keep my voice and honor and respect my voice and my Kentucky people and its history. I try not to read reviews. Those are no for authors. I'm an old girl, and I've experienced more than most folks have a dozen lifetimes. I'm right in Kentucky, and Kentucky and its history and people are complicated, messy, brutal, and beautiful. So I don't listen to the outside noise telling me what Kentucky should ever be like or how I should write Kentucky. I have to write it as honestly and authentically as I know how. I did want to tell you, Allison, one of the very first reviews came in from a gentleman who was a librarian, and he's also a Blueskin people. And he received the ARC, and he just had such high praise, and he sent the letter to me and my editors. So that meant everything, and that kind of meant I didn't need to be listening to anyone, you know, about my work and my writing. My writing's not going to be for everyone, but as long as I'd honored the Kentucky people. And then another librarian, a young Blueskin librarian, she could hardly express herself. She was crying so hard. You know, the book had honored her and lifted her up. So you know what? I said I set out to do my job. I got to get rid of any outside noise.
Yeah, you knew you were reaching the people that you wanted to reach.
Absolutely, that was the people I cared most about, and I loved it that anybody else would. But that's my thing.
Yeah, the books both speak so eloquently of the power of reading and writing and sharing books with one another as a way to communicate, as a way to be a part of a community. And I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about how reading and writing shaped your life and how you became a reader and a writer.
Well, as many know, I grew up in a rural Kentucky orphanage and on to foster care and then homeless as a teen. But when I was in the orphanage, I was always trying to get hold of scrap paper and write little poems and songs and everything. And on Sundays, we would have a show on. This is in the 60s, 1,000 years ago. But it was called The Wonderful World of Disney. And that was one of the rare shows that the nuns would let us watch. And I was just fascinated with Walt Disney when he would come on there and talk. So mainly I was writing him letters, poems, and everything. But more importantly, a plea to just please come get me, come take me out of here, you know. So it kind of started out very, very young. But that's the way it kind of started out, as far back as I can remember.
Did libraries also play a role in your life?
Yes, when I was in foster care, and that's very lonely when they would put you in foster care for the summer or something, and none of the kids wanted to play. You don't know anybody. And so there was a neighborhood library and I stopped in there. They said I could go, and not understanding anything really about it, got a book and went up there, and the librarian said, I think you've got more than one book in you. And she proceeded to get out a bag and helped me fill it up, and it was a very joyous summer for me.
Do you remember what any of those early books were that you read?
Oh, gosh. I think Charlotte's Web. I love that. It was just awful. It was just fascinating, brilliant to me. Where's Papa going with that axe? You know, I was hooked. Where is, you know, and yeah. Just anything, you know, I could get. There was not a lot of books to be or toys at all in the orphanage. So when I did get, you know, have a visit with foster care, it was a, you know, really nice that they had a library.
Yeah. One of the things that really seems to connect people to your work is the sense of place that you create and the richness of your characters' environments. How do you achieve that as a writer? What is it about the physical landscape that your characters inhabit that speaks to you?
Well, I'm lucky to live, you know, on a very small, tiny farm in a wilded spot in Kentucky. And nature has just always been my, where I can get solitude and get my mind sorted and so forth. And Kentucky, it's just so diverse in its landscapes across the region. And it's just so rich that it's just, I'm just able to take from that. It's like a character in itself, I think.
The books both reckon with racial and gender prejudice that Honey and her family experience and issues that we still struggle with today. What do Honey and her family have to teach us about how we see one another and honor each other's work?
Well, when I began writing this book now almost 8 years ago, my biggest hope was that if I could plant seeds of kindness, courage, and compassion, then I've done what I needed to do. The books have big themes, though, many themes: sexism, racism, nationalism, religion, ageism, and more. So it was really a really also simple message. It's how we treat people that are different from us differently. And that was the bottom line. It didn't matter about anything. It's just how we as a human race treat, you know, people that have all kinds of differences than us, whether it's physical, mental, whatever. And also it kind of wanted to show how fear and ignorance breeds toxicity into cultures. And because hate of any kind is a prejudice, and no matter where it's coming from or who it's aimed at, that's my way of thinking, and I'll never think any differently.
It must be tempting to create an easy answer to every problem that the characters face, and your books really don't do that. They, you know, not everything is tied up neatly in a bow.
No, there was no romanticism in 1930s poverty in Kentucky, and still in places in other parts of Kentucky. So Kentucky, you're not going to wrap us up in a bow. It just can't be had. I don't care what anybody from the outside thinks. I know my people. I'm an old girl. I've lived here all my life. I've been in every pocket, crook, and cranny of Kentucky, and we don't tie up so neatly in bows.
You mentioned before about hearing from people who, you know, who had direct experience of some of the things in your books. And I was just curious whether you had heard from people with the Pack Horse Librarian Project, what the stories that they were telling you were.
Yes, I've heard from the children and the relatives of the Pack Horse Librarian and how much it honored their legacy, and also from the, you know, the blue skin people, of course. And it just means a lot. I get a lot of folks reaching out. One woman, her mother was a pack horse librarian, and she died in 2013, Irene Crisp. And she said her mother was really ashamed of it because poverty, you know, they only paid them $28 a month. And there was eight of them. But she said Irene had to go to work at age 15 on the Pack Horse Librarian Project because her mother was sick in bed with TB and raising eight children. So the funny thing about this story was the first place the male supervisor told her not to go to the certain home up in the hills. And of course, 15 years and a 15-year-old, any century, any time, they're not going to listen to that. And she went riding her horse right up that mountain, and it was a brothel. So she dropped those books off every week.
They wanted to read too.
Yes, and they deserve to read.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. What? Tell me a little bit about the research that you did into the Pack Horse Librarian Project and some of the things that you learned when you were looking for information.
Well, I spent, like I said, over 5 years researching and writing this book because I knew it was going to be the first of its kind about the ladies. And I had to ensure that my Kentucky people didn't kill me and I got it all right, you know. So I had a little bit of that fear riding on it. But I went and we left home for a year, went and lived in a shack atop a mountain, and to further authenticate the Appalachia language, folks, everything. And then my husband got Lyme's, and then I fell and broke my arm off these crumbly mountain steps in Seven Park. So we said it's about time to come home. This book is cooked. Let's get home to our home, one room shack for a year, and bears and spiders and all kinds of critters, But that, I wouldn't trade it for anything. These women were they were fierce, and, they had to fight their own pandemics, treacherous landscapes, starvation, pellagra, mistrust, prejudices, all during Eastern Kentucky's most violent period, the bloody coal mine wars.
Yeah.
So look what they accomplished. Yeah. And I think the most fascinating thing was that this program actually started in 1913, and the wealthy coal baron that funded it, the Packhorse, he passed away, and so the program expired. The Kentucky Federation of Women's Club went back to Roosevelt, the WPA, and said, hey, we did this before. Can we do it again? He goes, I want those Kentucky women to get to work. I'll pay them $28. But they don't get any books, no mounts, or no place to house those books. Mm-hmm. And all through the midst of everything, the Depression, everything that's happening. So that was pretty... The resilience there was just,
that they managed to make do with, that they said, we'll do this however we have to do it, was remarkable.
And it became such an important bridge to education, for so many. It gave empowerment to the people, just a beautiful program.
Yeah. One of the things I really loved in both of the books was just the different reading material that people chose. So the different, it wasn't just bringing Bibles. It wasn't just bringing magazines. It was bringing all kinds of things for all different kinds of readers.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it was fascinating too, how the Packhorse librarians, when they didn't have enough books, they were making those scrapbooks and keeping in mind what their patrons wanted and needed.
Yeah. Yeah, they knew what their what their clientele was really looking for. Yeah. Who are some of the writers that you've read who you consider to have influenced you as a writer? Who would you like to be compared to or consider to have made footsteps that you follow?
Well, first of all, I don't know anybody who wants to be compared to me. The poor thing. But my go-to recommendations is Harriet Simpson Arnold, The Doll Maker. I just love that book. It just meant so much to me. Effie Waller Smith, the Black poet, love her works. Gwen Hyman Rubio, she's another one. And we all know Walter Tevis, The Queen's Gambit and all that, Kentucky Boy. So many of those, just love them. They've just, ones I just could read over and over. Some of the contemporary authors I like and was influenced. My earliest influence, was Alice Walker. I read that Color Purple and I thought, I love that they didn't take away her voice. Mm-hmm. And then I went to query that agent, and that's how I got my agent, and I knew if she was actually the editor, Susan Ginsberg, and I knew if she had respected that, she was going to respect this crazy old girl. And she did.
To be able to keep, but you're right, to be able to keep that distinctive, to not have to, dumb it down or translate it for some imagined audience of others is...
Right.
A major level of understanding.
And the respect that they gave me, as well as source books. It just has been tremendous. It's not been like, oh, you can't do this, or you can't, it's just been, such a gift and a blessing.
Yeah. When a book becomes a phenomenon like yours did, and it touches so many people in so many different places, from so many different places, people are able to see themselves in these characters and in kind of that, in that resilience and in that overcoming of obstacles and in that history. It speaks to the uniqueness of what you've created with these characters. And I'm wondering if there's, is there going to be more to this story after this?
I don't know that, you know, there's going to be more. I know that we're going to learn something that's happened. Soon the book world will know. So we're going to be working on a really project that's unbelievable. So we're waiting to share that news with the world. But I think a lot of people, you know, because Appalachia is so strange and foreign, like in one country, Bulgaria or somewhere where it's translated, they just think it's exotic. And I just can't, you know, when they sent the letter back, we're going to call it just Kentucky Bookwoman because we think Kentucky is exotic or something. But
oh my gosh.
We stay busy. We're busy on other projects, and hopefully we'll get to share some really great news.
But that's interesting about the translation. Because outside the U.S., and even inside the U.S., different places have different prejudices, different views of other places geographically within this country. And so, I didn't even consider how it might have sounded to someone reading it in Europe.
Well, and one of the first places to contact me was the U.S. Embassy in Moscow. They wanted me to visit with all the libraries and universities, which I couldn't get over how much they loved the story and the people and how it honored even their people. It was just, it was all done through translation, but it just blew me away that somebody there in Spain or where out these but can relate. Because Allison, as I said, I think more than anything, it was a book, you know, about kindness and dropping those seeds, you know, into a very charged and tumultuous world. In the 5 years that I was writing it, I knew the book sold in 2017. So it was like, keep focused, keep on. You want to murder somebody or take something, you know, but, you know, with all the world raining down, but just keep your pace. Keep thinking about what these women went through, what they did, you know, and keep it true.
Stay on the trail and get to your next patron. Who are some younger and contemporary writers whose work you're reading right now that interests you?
Younger? How young do they have to be?
in writing years, in newer books, let's say, or newer stories.
Oh, I have this this book I love by this author. It's called One Good Mama Bone by Bryn McLean. And the reason I love it, and it's been out a couple, 3 years maybe. And she took this cow, and if you can make me cry and ugly cry over this cow like that, I'll buy your grocery list. It won several awards, and it was just, I just couldn't get over that, you know. So that's one.
Well, is there anything that I haven't asked you that you wanted to talk about with our audience today?
Well, I'm excited for them to continue Honey's journey. Like I said, we have a female coal miner and the fire tower lookout and the frontier nurse, riding nurse, and that were just doing such remarkable jobs. I got to interview coal miners, one who worked side by side with her mother. Her mother's passed now. She worked in the 60s, 70s in the coal mines, but she, for a while got to, and this woman is like 29. She's worked in the coal mines still. And in fact, she worked it up to her 9 months pregnant, being down there 1,200 feet. So that was amazing. Amazing also to revisit fire tire lookouts and the history and the first women who manned those fire tire lookouts and study the Frontier Nursing Service of Kentucky. So Kentucky had some really great programs. We had the Moonlight Schools. We initiated that program here so people could walk, the elderly could walk up the moonlit paths to get education, learn their letters, and to read and write. We had so many fabulous programs.
Yeah. There must be a need and a hunger for contemporary versions of that in some cases. Lifelong yeah. learning and things like that.
Yeah, it's always look how far we've gone and how much further we have to go in life. I think that's just a big lesson.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being here with us. We really appreciate you being a part of the festival.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm honored.
Thanks so much. Have a wonderful rest of the day.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, author and Broadway director Shelley Williams discusses her children's picture book, Your Legacy, a bold reclaiming of our enslaved history, with journalist Ariane Nettles. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.